Hi, Chris Bentley here. Thanks for downloading this episode of Here and Now Anytime. We have some great stories in the works, deep dives on the arts, the environment, childcare, and much more. To get those, plus the top news of the day, make sure you subscribe or follow us in the app of your choice. Just search for Here and Now Anytime. And if you're already subscribed, I'd love it if you told a friend about us. And thanks. Now here's the show.
It sounds like they want to default if they can send junk to the president. It's not the president. It is McCarthy that's playing games with all of this.
What will it take to resolve the debt ceiling standoff? Well, it won't be the bill Republicans just passed in the House. It's Friday, April 28th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. On today's show, are your pets actually miserable? Some animal welfare scholars are complicating the pleasant idea we have about our bonds with our pets. And we've got some advice for how you can make your pet's life better.
Let your dog be a dog. Figure out what that means, and then let them do it.
That's coming up in about 6 minutes. And after that, we wrap up our series on ESG, three letters that have set off a culture war over how businesses invest your money. Today, what ESG really is, and why investors who do it say it's just good business. But first, a high-stakes game of chicken continues in Congress as Republicans use the debt ceiling to try to extract cuts to programs from student debt relief to renewable energy. Earlier this week, House Republicans passed a bill that would raise the debt ceiling and prevent the country from defaulting on its bills, but only if it also did things Republicans want, like make it harder to get food stamps or shift spending away from clean energy and toward fossil fuels. Democrats control the Senate, where the bill is now headed, so it's not going to become law. Still, the bill puts pressure on Democrats to make the next move. Yesterday, Jim Clyburn, the assistant House Democratic leader, spoke to Peter O'Dowd about where the negotiations go from here. Here's Peter.
And before we get into the politics, some economists are warning that the government could default even sooner, possibly in early June, if tax revenues continue to come in lower than expected. Can you add any clarity to the timeline here on the debt ceiling?
Well, no, I can't. I think the House passed for whatever it was put up by the Republicans, and it's going over to the Senate. And so the timelines will be determined by the Senate and its actions whenever they act, because whatever they do, it won't be what the House did. And then we have to have time to go to conference.
Well, as you said, that House bill is very likely to die in its current form in the Senate. Do you think that Chuck Schumer, the Senate leader, should even bring the bill to a vote?
Well, he's not going to bring that bill to vote. I mean, he can bring to a vote. As you said, it's like we said, dead on arrival. You don't have to, the Senate doesn't have to act on what they've done. They can come up with their own bill and send it back.
As you know, there are Democrats, more of them lately, in the House who think it's time to start talking with Republicans on this issue. This is Jared Golden. He's a moderate Democrat from Maine speaking with WGME.
The path forward begins with an acceptance of a very simple reality. We have to work together to do what's right for the country, and that requires negotiating in good faith.
All right. Do you agree, Congressman Clyburn? Time to negotiate?
Yeah, I agree. But negotiating in good faith is a whole lot different than negotiating. You've got a lot of negotiating going on out here, but I don't think what Republicans have been doing is in good faith. There's no way in the world anybody in his or her right mind believes that Democrats are going to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, rip all of these safety nets apart. That's not negotiating in good faith. Good faith to me means face up to the fact that we're talking about what we're going to do to pay the bills we've already incurred. This is about not about future spending.
So you say it is time for good faith negotiations. The president said again this week that he won't meet with Speaker McCarthy to discuss the debt limit. Does that mean you're on a different page than the president?
Does no,
it
that
sound
doesn't
like he's
mean
willing
that.
To? Because it sounds like he's willing to let the country default if he's not willing to do anything.
It sounds like they want to default if they can send junk to the president. The president has told them up front what he's not going to do. And so it's not the president, it is McCarthy that's playing games with all of this. He didn't take that position when Trump was up there and we did it three times. Why didn't he take that position with Trump?
I hear you, and it is very likely true that the Republicans are using this as an opportunity to extract concessions from the Democrats. I think that much is
clear.
Well,
they won't get any.
But at a certain point, what does it matter which party is to blame if the end result is that people don't get their Social Security checks, if their retirement accounts crash? I mean, doesn't the White House need to do anything it can to stop that from happening?
The president said we are not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to be cutting Medicare. We're not going to cut veterans' benefits. That we are going to deal with the good faith and credit of the United States based upon the debts we've already incurred. That's what he said. And if that's not good faith, I don't know. If you're going to do an appropriations bill and you want to see what we're going to spend going forward, negotiate the appropriations bill. You don't negotiate the debt that's already incurred, talking about what you aren't going to, what you're going to hold hostage. For the future. That's quite simple to me.
So what's the next step? What do Democrats do now?
What do you mean what do Democrats do? What do Republicans do? What do Republicans do? The Democrats will come out of the Senate with a Democratic bill. That's what we're going to do. The Republicans got the Republican bill. Then we go to conference.
Finally, Congressman, I want to ask you about President Biden's decision this week to run for re-election. As you know, he'll be 86 years old when he leaves office. His poll numbers are pretty low. The economy is slowing down. It's an issue. Inflation still here. I'm sure you'll support him, but do you think he can overcome these headwinds?
Well, I think he stands a much better chance of overcoming his numbers than 4-5 does. So I think Biden is in very good shape for the future. I think that this whole notion about his age, and I'm going to say to you what I've said to a lot of other people, I'd much rather have an 86-year-old Thurgood Marshall than a 45-year-old Clarence Thomas.
South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn, Assistant House Democratic Leader, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Coming up next, how's your cat, or your dog, or your fish? Are they happy? The act of owning a pet is a labor of love and empathy, but it's complicated. You try to provide for the well-being of a life that you might not ever fully understand. Well, animal welfare experts are learning more about how our pets might be feeling, and it's kind of uncomfortable news. But we do have some advice for you, too, on how you can make your pet's life better. Peter picks up the story after the break.
If you have a pet, brace yourself for this next story, because your beloved dog or cat, and most definitely your bird, is miserable living with you. Now, don't blame me for saying that. It was Kenny Torella who wrote an article for Vox called The Case Against Pet Ownership.
The origin story of my article began with my 3-year-old dog, Evie. You know, I work from home, so I'm able to give her a lot of walks and playtime. And yet, I always wondered, is Evie just bored and frustrated all day from being cooped up inside?
Well, maybe Evie is bored and frustrated all day, but not my dog, not Bisbee, surely. No, no. We need to bring in Jessica Pierce. She is an animal ethicist and author of Run, Spot, Run, The Ethics of Keeping Pets. Jessica, come on, it can't be true. Our pets are miserable?
We tend to think of the animals who live in our homes as really pampered and well-protected, and we love them, so obviously they must be happy. But as a matter of fact, animals who live in our homes as our pets are, I think, one of the most miserable populations of animals on the planet. I think that's a really hard thing for people who live with animals to hear, because we love our pets. That's why we acquire them, and that's why we live with them, and we really try to give them good care often, but we put them into human environments that are really challenging for them in many ways.
I think you're right. It's very hard for people to hear this. You know, I've been talking with friends and acquaintances ever since I read Kenny's article, and no one has been willing to admit that their dog or their cat or, you know, their pet is unhappy. In fact, they say, no, my dog has the best life. I take it on 2 walks a day, you know, it sleeps in my bed. So are you saying what we think is a good existence for our pet may not actually be what they need?
Yes, that is what I'm saying. And, you know, I think in the case of dogs, we do our best, but it's really not enough often for dogs. And we tend to look at their world and their experiences from our perspective. And what I try to encourage people to do is to step into the paws or claws of the animals themselves and say, what does the world look like from their perspective? And to give one example, you know, we might think it's a great gift that we just feed dogs a bowl of kibble twice a day. Like, they don't have to do any work. But as a matter of fact, meaningful work is really important for animals. Animals need to have purpose in life. It's what they have evolved to do. You know, food gathering, foraging is one of the most basic patterns of behavior that animals have evolved. And if an animal doesn't have the opportunity to engage in those behaviors, they end up feeling out of control, frustrated, bored, and maybe acting out, which seems to be an issue we have with companion dogs.
So those are the signs of a frustrated dog. But how do you know that they're miserable? I mean, is there data or research to back that up?
Yes, I do think there's plenty of research to back it up. And, you know, I could mention a couple of studies that have really stood out to me. One is a general large-scale study that was published in 2020. And they looked at the medical records of almost 14,000 dogs. So this is a big, big study. And they found that 75%, so 3/4 of all dogs suffer from some anxiety-related problem. That's a lot. Some of the other ways you might triangulate the problem of stress in dogs is by looking at the literature on dog behavioral problems, which can be a manifestation of a dog who's struggling to adapt to his or her environment. You know, there was a study out of Japan that found that 86%, so I mean, pretty close to almost all dog owners, reported that their dog had behavioral problems. That's a lot of dog behavioral problems. And it's not a canine crime wave. It's dogs struggling.
But I don't understand. I don't understand. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but, you know, haven't these animals, dogs and cats, like, haven't they evolved over many, many years to be our companions? Because, in fact, we're both good for each other.
Yes, they have. And they are more comfortable in human environments than many other kinds of animals. For example, you know, wild-caught, exotic creatures who simply are miserable as pets. And I think dogs and cats and other domesticated social mammals can live happily with humans and in human environments. But the way that I've talked about it in my work is dogs are more intensively captive than they used to be. So, I mean, some of that is related to regulations. Like, it's illegal for a dog to be off leash unless they're in a designated off leash dog area. So they no longer have the freedom to simply roam around, which is something that dogs behaviorally are really motivated to do. They roam around. They cover a lot of ground. If you look at the research coming out on free roaming dogs around the world, which are incidentally about 80% of the dogs on the planet live on their own and not as pets, their lives are quite different. And we can get some ideas about what might be stressing our pet dogs by looking at how dogs live who have more freedom.
Do you have a pet?
I do. I have a dog named Bella, who's, we got her when she was about one. She's 12 now. She was picked up off the street by animal control. So she's our family member. She's the only pet we have at the moment.
The reason I asked you about Bella is because, you know, there's people in your field who've been saying that it's time to consider the end of pet ownership altogether, which sounds ambitious, but how do you come down on that?
I'm moving in that direction as well. And I think that Bella may be my last dog. And it's not that I necessarily think it's wrong for people to live with dogs. I don't. I think the dog-human relationship is beautiful. It's powerful. Like, there's nothing else like it. But for me, the responsibility of giving Bella a decent life under the constraints that we're in is a lot of responsibility. And I'm tired. Yeah. I feel guilty if I go on a trip. I feel guilty that I'm not giving her enough enrichment from morning to night. And it's just, it's a lot of pressure. Because their entire life, their entire happiness is in our hands. If you think about it, that's a pretty heavy moral responsibility.
You've kind of broken my heart here because you love your Bella. I love my Bisbee more than seems normal on most days. Can you tell us, you know, one thing that people can do to make our pets' lives better?
Yes. The most important thing we can do is give them a greater sense of control over their own lives and their own environment. And there are a million ways to do that, and you can get really creative. But just to give one quick example, you know, when I take Bella out for walks, she can't walk very much because she's got some serious mobility issues. But when we go out, it's about her. And I probably look funny to other people. But I let her choose the pace. I let her choose the direction. If you know, she wants to go into the middle of a muddy field in order to sniff something, I will go there with her. And for her, it's really about smelling, especially now that she can't run around. It's really about taking in her sensory environment. And I try to let her be a dog. And sometimes that means, you know, if she wants to roll in the grass or in the field, and sometimes I don't know what she's rolling in, I let her do it because, like, you know, she doesn't have that much excitement in her life. So when she can find these small moments of joy, I embrace them for her. Let your dog be a dog, figure out what that means, and then let them do it.
Jessica, we've talked a lot about dogs and some about cats. What about other animals? Is there any pet that a person can responsibly keep, in your opinion?
So, yeah, the pets that I would favor are domesticated, small, social mammals. And one of my favorite pets, and I know it might make members of your audience go, ew, that is the rat. My daughter had, I can't even tell you how many rats growing up. We're talking about not brown rats, but Norway rats. They're lovely. They're not inclined to bite like hamsters and gerbils. They actually enjoy interaction. But I really think you can give them interesting lives. And in return, they are wonderful friends.
Animal ethicist Jessica Pierce, thank you so much for your time. It sounds like you're a great pet owner. But thank you for your insights. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I try my best and nobody's perfect.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we've been digging into the conservative culture war against environmental, social, and governance investing, or ESG. Today, Scott Tong gets two views on the issue, one from a Republican running for president, and another from an investor who says ESG is not about politics. It's just good business. Stick around for the conclusion of Scott's series.
We have been reporting on a new target in the culture wars: banks and other financial companies that conservatives slam as woke. Wall Street titans push lefty, big government politics, according to conservative entrepreneur and commentator Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for president.
A lot of Americans had their retirement funds or their 401k funds invested in funds that are managed by, say, BlackRock.
Here he is in an interview with us.
What they do is they buy up shares in American companies in the stock market. So far, so good. No problem. However, the real problem emerges when they start to use that money to, say, go to Apple and say that we're going to vote in favor of a racial equity audit.
As his argument goes, these closet Wall Street liberals strong-arm the companies they invest in to be politically correct, under the cover of an investment strategy with a blasé acronym, ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance Investing. Now, the firms actually doing ESG have told us, hold on, we're calling BS. This is a total misrepresentation. So, okay, let's hear from someone on the inside.
I'm John Stroyer. I'm the chairman of Calvert Research and Management.
John Stroyer has been doing ESG investing for decades. His firm, Calvert, is based in Washington, D.C. Stroyer takes me on a small shopping trip to show and tell Calvert's ESG approach. And just outside his office, a fancy new Washington, D.C. Metro bus pulls away. The D.C. Metro bus system has a newer fleet that has the newer engines from the Cummins company. I understand Cummins has a high ESG score.
Cummins has consistently innovated on fuel efficiency, and Cummins is also a leader in helping to develop hydrogen fuel technology. Green hydrogen is a potential fuel of the future.
He's talking about the letter E in ESG, environment. The idea is to bet on companies that Calvert thinks will be around long term, and to bet against many fossil fuel companies that Destroyer could be endangered.
Oil, when burned, creates carbon emissions, which are held to be responsible for warming and climate change. And so therefore, there are lots of innovators, lots of initiatives to try to create a different energy system.
If you back up, imagine a few hundred years ago, if you thought energy only comes from burning wood, you would have missed out on, say, coal, and then oil.
The world has been through a transition from wood to coal, and then coal to oil. Now we're going to have competition from renewables. Companies that did not adapt well to electric motors, for instance, and stayed with steam engines, struggled and went out of business.
Just across the street, there's a church with a grassy space and impressive weed management. Now, the dominant product in this space is Roundup, made by Monsanto, now owned by Bayer. Roundup is on the Calvert naughty list. The World Health Organization says Roundup's main ingredient probably causes cancer, although the EPA disagrees.
The company continues to be subject to large and ongoing lawsuits that are resulting in significant liabilities. The second problem with Roundup in particular is that it has been used so heavily. The weeds, actually, that it seeks to kill have evolved quickly, and there are now Roundup-resistant weeds.
The point he's trying to make is ESG investing is about companies and their risks, not their politics.
We are not trying to, we can't change the world. We are trying to help companies adapt to the world as it changes around them.
Of course, Calvert Research and Management and other ESG investors have to make money. Because if they can't deliver good returns to investors, well, game over.
Calvert indexes and Calvert actively managed strategies have produced competitive investment returns, often market-beating investment returns. Performance is first and foremost.
Calvert says its largest fund has lower fees than most comparable funds, and that it's in the top 10% for performance. All right, let's move on to the letter S in ESG. S is for social. As in, how does a company treat its workers? Are there labor abuses in its supply chain? For a bit of show and tell, let's take a household object. A paring knife from the Henkels brand carried by Williams-Sonoma, which has a high ESG score. Williams-Sonoma's supply chain is considered responsible. And that kind of sounds like do-gooder politics, doesn't it? Well, John Stroyer at Calvert says, nope, dodgy supply chains are business risks.
If one company is dealing with a supply chain that is violating local environmental laws, human rights violations. It's making money because that supply chain is cheap and its costs are low versus a second company that has a high-quality supply chain.
A company cutting corners could invite workers to revolt, damaging its reputation, and that costs money. Or if it pollutes the water nearby, the company could be sued or fined.
Good suppliers that are adhering to local regulations may be a more expensive supply chain today, but it's going to be there for 20 years. And that's what we look for in the case of Williams-Sonoma. They've got excellent policies in terms of what their supply chain looks like.
ESG investors research things like supply chains by hiring special researchers and buying information to learn about companies and their risks. And then they turn that information into data and they rank companies. In other words, they're creating new geeky metrics and they hope to win. Remind you of a certain movie?
Every at-bat's like a hand of blackjack. Every card that's dealt, your odds completely change. So every first pitch strike, your batting average goes down about 75 points.
75 points?
Moneyball, the Brad Pitt movie about the Oakland A's and the triumph of baseball data nerds.
He should be throwing 100 pitches before the fifth inning.
I'm going to knock that starter out and eat deep into their bullpen. I want you taking at bats off the 10th and 11th pitcher by the end of the series.
The game for ESG investors who put their money into investment companies like Calvert is to trust that this will bring better returns in the long run. Which takes us to the G in ESG, governance, which in English means how well is the company run? And for that, I pull out my favorite game, Taboo.
You ever played Taboo before?
I have not.
First of all, you do need to play it, but Taboo is a Hasbro game. I understand Hasbro has a high ESG score. Any thoughts as to why?
I think it has a good governance system, it has decent diversity.
Hasbro has a board that's diverse enough to get the attention of Calvert's research director, Helen Bugwa. Now, why in the world does diversity matter to companies?
They have customers that they serve. If you have people who think alike, do not have diversity of thought or diversity of could be color, ethnicity, I think you might not be able to really, in the best way, serve the communities in which you operate.
Research from Standard & Poor's found that firms with female executives perform better than the market average, as do companies with gender diversity on their boards. Conversely, a lack of diversity could invite business missteps. Bugwa brings up what happened to Adidas in 2020.
The HR person was asked about diversity, especially around the George Floyd time period. And they said, just the whole talk about race is noise. And then they put out a couple of products that were not very sensitive to certain parts of the community.
By the way, one of those products that rang off key was a sneaker for Black History Month, which was entirely white.
And once we started digging into this, then you realize that there was a lack of diversity.
Still, that does not convince ESG critic Vivek Ramaswamy. He thinks the data connecting diversity to profits
is cherry-picked. For example, there's no such data as it applies to sexual orientation, because that data has never been collected. Or with respect to race, the evidence doesn't exist yet. And yet, the diversity agenda as part of the S prong of ESG still demands those things too.
There are other knocks on ESG investing. High fees for some ESG funds, which Calvert denies that it offers, and that companies they invest in can overstate or sugarcoat how environmentally and socially responsible they actually are. It's called greenwashing. You may recall VW's supposed eco-friendly cars actually gamed emissions tests, or that McDonald's used paper straws that were not recyclable. In fact, John Stroyer, again of Calvert, admits this challenge. It's really hard to know what specific data on pollution, on labor issues, on running a company actually matter to the bottom line.
That's the knock on ESG data. There's a lot of data out there in the ESG world that actually does not matter to long-term investment decisions. It either lacks the quality or it's not relevant.
Still, when ESG investing works and it translates into investment returns, it shows, according to the team at Calvert, that there is a clear business case for ESG.
Scott Tong there, wrapping up our series on ESG. If you missed the previous two episodes, you can find them at hereandnow.org or on this podcast from the previous two Fridays. On April 14th's episode of this show, we heard leaked audio from a Heritage Foundation fellow who said what he calls woke capital is, quote, more insidious than communism or the Nazis. And last Friday, on April 21st, we heard how the culture war over ESG has real-life winners and real-life losers, not just on Wall Street. Head to hereandnow.org to hear all of those and more stories. Our ESG series was produced by Jill Ryan. She's part of the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's interview with Representative Clyburn was produced by Kalyani Saxena. And Gabrielle Healy handled that conversation on pets. Today's editors were Gabe Bullard, Todd Munt, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now, that's Carlene Watson. Thanks to them and everyone who produces our show. And thanks to you for listening. We will be back on Monday. Hope you have a great weekend.